Professor Linda Darling-Hammer. Great expert, great researcher in teacher education and teaching and learning. She is Professor of Education Emeritus at Stanford University and President of the Learning Policy Institute, which connects research to policy and practice in the course of more equitable and empowering learning. At Stanford, she founded the Stanford Center for Opportunity Policy in Education and the School Resign Network, and served as the faculty sponsor of the Stanford Teacher Education Program, which she helped to redesign. So we could say that Linda is one or even the most excellent expert in the world in teacher education and issues concerning teaching and teachers' work. Many of her books are very widely well known. For example, the books What Matters Most, Teaching for America's Future, and then the book The Right to Learn, Teaching as the Learning Profession, Prepare Teachers for Changing World, and then also the book Flat World and Education. Linda has 14 honorary degrees in different universities all over the world, also at the University of Helsinki, awards for the quality and impact of her research. So we are very pleased and happy to have Professor Emerita Linda Darling-Hammer here in our Tibet conference. The floor is yours, Linda.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's a very gracious introduction from someone I have learned so much about teacher education from. And it's wonderful to see so many. Ah. Is that better? Ah, yes. we're getting used to all the technologies here. So it's wonderful to be here with people from so many different countries working on the same issues and the same problems. All over the world, although we have different manifestations at the core, many of the issues are very, very much the same. And I'm going to talk this morning from the perspective of teaching as an expert profession, which I think is a contended idea in many countries. It certainly is in the United States, and it is in many other places as well. I think that has been Finland has been an outlier in that regard for many years, but even there, you've got the budgetary cuts that many of us have experienced. So what we're all dealing with, I think, in one way or another, are the challenges of 21st century teaching, which is in many ways very different from 20th century teaching. All of our societies have a greater need for education. In the United States, about 70% of jobs now require specialized knowledge work. That was, 100 years ago, 5% of the population. We still have schools that are preparing a minority of students for the kind of thinking work that is now the dominant part of the society. And we have to redesign those schools as well as the teaching that goes on within them. I live right up the street from Silicon Valley, Google, Facebook, Yahoo. That is the surrounding near where I live. If you go to Google to try to get a job, they will not look at your test scores. They will not look at your grades. They will try to figure out what your learning ability is. And they'll put you in situations where you have to find information yourself. You have to weigh and balance the information. You have to work with a team to try to solve a problem. Then you have to try to test your solution and see if you can improve it. And that's the basis of the hiring process, because it's not about having knowledge. It's about using information and finding it and figuring out what it means. So that's, the nature of education is changing. The nature of learning is changing. All around the world, we've seen countries develop new standards and curriculum for learning. Every society has increasing diversity of students because of migration and immigration all over the world. All of us are trying to do a better job of educating students who have different learning needs so that they are enabled to find the best path in the society. And in every society, there are greater expectations that schools can ensure student success. In the 20th century, the idea was offer education, and either students will learn or they won't. Now the idea is you have to actually ensure learning for students, and that's a very different job for teaching. And while that's going on in many countries, there is a debate on teacher education, how much to invest in it, whether everyone should have it, and on teacher quality. Now, of course, it's probably been the worst in the U.S. This is our U.S. Secretary of Education in 2002 put out a report on teacher quality, which argued there is little evidence that education school work leads to improved student achievement. Knowledge of pedagogy, degrees in education, the amount of time spent practice teaching that make up the current teacher certification regimes are surrounded by a great deal of contention. Virtually all of the studies linking certification and improved student outcomes are not scientifically rigorous. So we've been through a huge era, and we're not alone, of contention around whether universities can do teacher education well and whether the outcomes of that preparation, in fact, make a difference in whether teachers are more effective and students learn more. So this idea of whether teaching should be an expert profession is one that is certainly on the table around the world, as we see with Teach for All, Teach for Australia, Teach for America, Teach for Norway, etc. The idea that a smart college graduate could come in, forget about teacher education, go straight into the classroom and do just as well is one of the ways in which the question of teaching as an expert profession is being raised in many societies. We have to ask, do we expect teachers to be effective in promoting learning? There's a question of whether there's a knowledge base that influences effectiveness, and then can it be acquired, disseminated, and expanded? And I really appreciated the comments of Professor Wayne yesterday at the opening ceremony about the question of how do we think about theory and practice, and the notion that it may be less about putting theory into practice than understanding practice in a way that we can theorize what's effective and understand how to transmit it. Well, because of this challenge in the United States, we've had a blizzard of studies about the effectiveness of teacher education. Among them are these two very large-scale studies in North Carolina and New York, which found that student learning gains are related to teachers having a strong academic background, having had teacher preparation before they entered teaching, not while they were there or ever, having certification in the field that they actually teach, being experienced, more than 3 years of experience has a very substantial effect on teachers' effectiveness. And then in North Carolina, there are a lot of teachers who have something called National Board Certification, which is decided through a portfolio of teachers' work that is submitted and scored by other teachers that demonstrates whether they are able to identify student learning needs and organize a curriculum that is responsive to those needs and responsive to a curriculum that expects higher-order thinking skills and problem-solving to be the result of education. And in North Carolina, together, these features of teaching predicted more of the difference in student learning gains than race and parent education combined, which is a very substantial effect. So if we really cared about effective teaching, we would strengthen and equalize these features. But in most societies around the world, what we see is that some students get teachers who have all of these attributes, and in the sort of highest achieving countries, virtually all teachers have all of these attributes. But in others where they are unequally allocated, the more advantaged students are likely to get the more expert teachers, and the less advantaged students are likely to get the less experienced and less expert teachers. We've also found that preparation reduces teacher attrition. Teachers who have had practice teaching, who've gotten feedback and observation of their teaching and of other classes, who've learned about learning theory and child development and curriculum and materials, are about twice as likely to stay in teaching, not only after the first year, as this graph shows, but after as many as 5 years. So it makes a difference. Teachers who are better prepared are more likely to stay because, in fact, they feel more efficacious. They're having greater success, and teaching is more rewarding for them. As these issues get contended, one of the underlying themes is whether we hold a bureaucratic approach to education or a professional approach to education. In a bureaucratic approach, we think of expertise as sitting at the top of the system. Teachers are expected to have relatively minimal skills. Research and tests and texts are aimed at controlling practice, telling teachers what to do. Decisions are made hierarchically. The emphasis is on doing things right, on doing things in a standardized way, according to procedure. Schools function more or less as assembly lines. In a professional conception, expertise rests in the classroom, in the hands of the teacher, in the mind of the teacher. Teachers are expected to have extensive knowledge and skill. Research is aimed at informing practice, not controlling it. Decisions are made with colleagues based on standard of practice. The emphasis is on doing what works, doing the right things, rather than doing things right. And schools function as communities of learning, as professional learning communities. And in many countries, these are still contended. In many places, teacher education is today where medical education was in 1910. In 1910, you could become a doctor by studying for a few weeks, memorizing a list of symptoms and a list of cures that went with those symptoms. You could follow another doctor around in a buggy and sell tonics that were purported to cure cancer and baldness at the same time. Or you could study in a place like Johns Hopkins University, where they had invented the first teaching hospital, where you studied the sciences of medicine and applied those sciences in a setting designed to emulate best practices and to be the place where you could bring theory and practice together. That model, as you know, was taken up first in the United States. Abraham Flexner did a big report called the Flexner Report. He was actually a secondary high school teacher who had become a researcher and went around and did that study. And basically what happened was they held up that model as the basis for accrediting schools of medicine. All of the schools of medicine then began to adopt that notion of teaching hospitals. Now all over the world, doctors are trained in similar ways in teaching hospitals attached to universities where theory and practice are brought together. And I think we are at a similar moment in education where solving that theory and practice problem that was raised last night and that I'm going to speak more about is the key strategy to having an expert profession that is recognized as one. As I noted, what happened in medicine was the common preparation design was built on the most successful models. Those are updated regularly based on research and professional judgment, an integration of coursework with clinical work, rather than one being over here and the other being over there and no connection between the two. The required internships and residencies conducted in the affiliated teaching hospitals, I think, are the key element. And then they move to performance-based licensure and accreditation, which is something that some countries are taking up in teaching today. So if we were to think about this question of what do we know about high leverage practices for teacher education, there was a volume that was initiated by one of the key teachers unions in the United States, the American Federation of Teachers, and conducted through our National Academy of Education, which brought together sort of expert teacher educators, researchers, and teachers to try to assemble what we know about not only teacher education generally, but the kind of teacher education that is responsive to how we know people learn. We've learned a lot in cognitive science about the fact that learning itself has to be applied, that we have to have opportunities for inquiry in the process of learning in order for it to be able to develop adaptive expertise. So moving from the kind of learning which is rote-oriented to the kind of learning that is inquiry-oriented, then what do we know about teacher education that supports that kind of learning was really the challenge of that book. And so what I want to do is take a moment and pick up on the theme that we talked about or heard about yesterday of thinking about practice as an instantiation of theory, as a way of thinking about theory. And I want to show you a teacher, and I'm going to ask you to think about her practice. We'll see a couple of minutes of practice of a teacher who gets extraordinary outcomes in a very high-need community in Detroit. Let's see if we can get her to come up. And think about what you see theoretically in this practice.
I got a second class, and that's where I was going to do. So you can't do that, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, and you start practicing and start feeling wrong. You ain't going to know
anything. I have to get us back to the beginning of the... thing. Which may or may not work. Do you have an idea?
It's okay to me.
Is it not showing up?
No, not yet.
We want to find out if it's true that the cellular membrane is permeable. Means it lets things in and out, right? So we're going to use an egg, okay, everyone? We're going to use an egg. You see in the classroom when I asked the students, how would you get the membrane initially? That a lot of them thought, well, I'll boil the egg. Because they took their past experiences, they boil the egg, they peel it off, the membrane's right there. But I had to get them to understand that this is a living cell, and the living cell has cytosol. It has cytoplasm, that's where I was going to. So you can't do that, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, and you start practicing and start peeling off. And you ain't going to know anything.
My heart would have to be easy.
How to dissolve it. And then that made them interested. If I would have just said, okay, today you are going to dissolve the membrane of an egg in vinegar, they would have said, okay, today. And if I would ask them 2 days later, what did you dissolve? What acid did you use? They would say, I don't know, whatever you told us to. But see, now if I ask them, they'd say vinegar. And I'd say, why? Because the pH is low enough to dissolve the membrane, to dissolve the eggshell without affecting the membrane. So that's why I did it. A couple of the groups broke their egg accidentally. And they thought, oh, the experiment is now a disaster. But that's, I wanted them to understand that that happens to scientists, that there's limitations in life. But the scientific word is a limitation. What's the problem? What happened? What is this? You're a scientist.
Limitation.
So why is it a limitation?
All the membrane, all the shell belong to the
membrane is off.
Okay, exactly. What is this?
Membrane.
All right, let's look at it.
Yeah.
All right, can you describe the membrane? Yeah. Absolutely. So, if it's rubbery, do you, is there pores in it? Well, we can't see them. How can you prove there are pores in this? But without a microscope, how could you prove in your scientific investigation of this?
Vinegar
it was a perfect opportunity for them to see the consistency of the membrane and to see they can't see the pores. They cannot see the pores, but they're microscopic. Well, they read that, or they learned that in some past experience that we've done, because I didn't lecture them. So that was a learning experience for them. What happened? They have to feel secure in making a mistake and not thinking that they're going to be ridiculed by me or the other students in the classroom, and they have to be able to take chances. I don't know anything, and the kids can ask me something, and if I don't know and I tell them, no, I'm going to look it up, they feel more secure with me asking them questions and them not knowing the answers. But the best thing to do is to go around and catch it. Catch them while they're doing it and get them to think about it.
Okay, what did you see in the practice that you would be thinking about exemplifying the theories that we work with in teacher education? Yes?
It's learning through discovery. Learning through discovery.
Right. Okay. What else? Yes?
This is inquiry-based learning.
Yes, it is. Other?
Peer learning.
Peer learning, so we see the collaboration being well managed. Yeah.
I think the students will actually, get the solution themselves rather than give it to them.
Say that again?
Getting the students to get to the solution themselves rather than giving it to them.
Right, so carefully scaffolded tasks and questions to get them there. Yes?
Vulnerability.
Say it again?
Vulnerability.
Yeah?
Environment.
Yeah?
Trusts.
Yeah? So a lot of psychological ideas about safety, vulnerability, trust, all of that is being exemplified there. Other, yes?
You drew up a prior experience of the whole group in a way that made the learning accessible to everyone.
Right, building on prior knowledge and experience. Yes?
The relationships.
Yeah. Yes, sir?
I've seen a shift in the responsibility onto the students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely, and very explicitly done. Any others that you noticed? Yes?
Teacher's theory and practice are in line. What teacher's talk is the walk she's walking, so there's no contradiction there.
Yeah, exactly. So that's another really good insight.
Collaborative learning. Yeah,
definitely, collaborative. So you can see a lot of the things that we would talk about in theoretical terms in teacher education, instantiated in practice. And our challenge is to figure out how to teach this in a way that actually brings these examples and instantiations to life, so that students know what it means when we talk about these broad and general ideas, but that's what that looks like in the classroom. That's how you do this in the classroom. Another one that I like about what she's doing is she keeps talking to them about we're scientists ourselves. So she's building an academic identity for the students. There's a lot of identity work that's also going on along with technical work. Another thing I see there, we talk a lot in the U.S. about academic language development, that there's a lot of linguistic development. And I learned a lot of scientific language just listening to her in that little moment. So she's very good at thinking about how do you make the concepts come alive as you're developing the practice as well as the inquiry as well as the learning of the we're back on online the learning of the vocabulary. So many things. So the question is, how do we have opportunities in teacher education for students to see, experience this kind of learning from these kinds of teachers tightly connected to the way in which they are learning the theory, so that they don't have to do the work of saying, I heard this vague stuff over here, I'm seeing some other things over there, I don't really see the connection. That's really our key job, I think. We know a lot now about effective teaching, that we see that kind of active learning building on students' experience, an intellectually ambitious task, teachers using a variety of teaching strategies and knowing when to use which strategies for which purposes, with which children, making decisions about the use of appropriate strategies, using assessment to adapt teaching to student needs, not just to give grades, the effective scaffolding and the support for language as well as content learning, standards and feedback, Opportunities for revising work have become very important, and many of you mentioned the collaborative classroom. Beyond that, with the emphasis on teaching all children, on finding equitable ways to develop learning, we have to think about what equitable teachers need to understand. And that is, to my mind, especially developing what I think of as a two-way pedagogy, where it's not just the teacher to the student, I'm telling you what I know that you should learn, but it's the teacher looking at, listening to, and learning from the student about how they're thinking, about how they're experiencing the learning, about what they bring to the classroom, about how to build on their experiences and knowledge. And those are specific pedagogical tools that we need, as well as the tools to communicate content. Some of you know the work, I'm sure, of Lee Shulman around content pedagogy. There's also a strain of work Peter Grimmett and others have worked on learner pedagogy, that you need a pedagogy that helps you understand learners, as well as one that helps you divulge and organize learning around the student themselves. A key idea that has recently emerged in this arena is the idea of academic mindset, developing ways that students will have the confidence to keep struggling when they learn. And some of you may know this. Carol Dweck, my colleague at Stanford, has been working on this idea. They found that, people tend to have two different kinds of mindsets. One is that intelligence is inherent. Either you're smart or you're not smart, and you're good or you're not good at a particular thing. Most of the people in the United States believe they are not good in mathematics. You will hear that all over the country. People in other cultures may have a different view. But a growth mindset is one that says intelligence is developed, and the more I work on something, the smarter I'll get, the more confident I'll be. And people develop these mindsets about different things. Students who had equivalent achievement at the beginning of a moment in time, they were studying mathematics initially, who had a growth mindset, continued to do well and got better over time. Those who had a fixed mindset saw their grades and their performance drop, even though they started at the same place. And it turns out that teachers can actually help develop a growth mindset by the way they work with students to help them think about the role of effort in their learning, to see as they revise their work that it's getting better and therefore that they are making progress. So all of these are parts of the teacher education dilemma, which is how do we help our young teachers understand not only how to disseminate content, but how to create these attributes in learners so that they can continue to be independent learners through their learning careers. So in the Preparing Teachers as a Changing World, we kind of thought about the what of teacher education, the knowledge you need about learners and learning in social contexts, the knowledge that you might need about subject matter and curriculum, the knowledge that you might need about teaching subject matter to diverse learners, assessment, classroom management. But at the core of those is this idea of a vision for professional practice. What does it look like when it comes all together? And one of our key jobs, if we're going to bring theory and practice together, is to help prospective teachers get a vision of professional practice that is well-developed and well-understood. In some ways, that may be happening through coursework and tools that we use at the university, videos and other tools like that. A lot of it is going to happen in the classroom where they get student teaching experience. And if that experience is going to resonate to the work that's going on in the university, those have to be brought very closely together, right? The vision that you experience of professional practice has to be articulated and connected to the work that's going on in the university. It's probably the single hardest thing we need to do in teacher education, because all of the great readings and lectures and theories and conversations and discussions that we can have will be trumped by what happens in the classroom. And if those are working in tandem, then they will be reinforced and exponentially made stronger. And if they are not in tandem, then one will trump the other. Then the other part of the challenge is the how of teacher education. And we have certain perennial dilemmas that we have to deal with. One is the apprenticeship of observation that Dan Lordy talked about years ago, that everybody's had many years of schooling and they've watched teachers teach and they have an idea that they know what education is when they come into teacher education. I think of this often like when we go to a concert and we see a composer and the composer is conducting. It looks very simple. We say, I could do that. Look, I wave my arms and, you know, magic comes out. That's what teaching is like for a student, right? They see the teacher doing things. Looks very simple. And they have ideas about what that means without understanding all of the thinking and work that's in the background. So part of our job is to sometimes confront misconceptions that have come about through that apprenticeship of observation, and other times to illuminate those hidden features of the teacher's thinking and behavior. The problem of enactment is a huge problem because you just knowing what to do doesn't enable you necessarily to do it. It's so much harder to be in a classroom managing the complexity of all the things that are going on, the multiple goals and so on. So some people who are very good students in the academy are not very good teachers if they can't figure out how to enact the ideas in the classroom. So we need lots of opportunities for practicing that enactment and for being immersed in that complexity sufficiently to begin to understand how to manage and juggle. An additional problem that we have today is whether we prepare teachers for schools as they currently are or for schools as they must become in a world that is rapidly changing, where the knowledge is expanding exponentially. Technology knowledge, by the way, is doubling every 11 months right now. So the idea that we will somehow just take all the knowledge that exists and divide it up into the 12 years of schooling or however many they are and, you know, allocate them and shift them to be remembered is so far from what we will need our students to become. And then there's the fact that teachers need to move from a concern for themselves, how am I doing, thinking, you know, very self-focused, to a concern for learners. And how do we help them move to that concern for learners? In a context that includes subject matter and that includes the communities of practice. Well, some years ago I did a study which was published in this book, Powerful Teacher Education, where I ran around because I had heard in various cities employers say things, principals of very good schools doing extraordinary work with very diverse learners. And they would say things like this: I've sought out Bank Street graduates in all my positions in the last 10 years. Or in Boston, Wheelock does a better job of preparing early childhood teachers than any place I know. Similarly for Alverno in Milwaukee or Berkeley, I'll take all the Berkeley grads I can get. So it was clear in the world of practice that there were some schools of education that were producing teachers who were arriving ready to do the job, not only of presenting well or keeping the classroom, but really working to enhance student learning in context with students with high levels of learning need. What were they doing was the question. So we found that in looking at these programs, using a variety of tools, surveys of graduates and of employers, on the interviews, focus groups, observations of practice, and so on, that these programs had several things in common. One was a very tightly knit set of experience that had this common, clear vision of good teaching. And that vision of good teaching was agreed to by all of the professors who were working in that program, all the supervisors who were working in the schools, all of the schools where people practiced were selected because they exemplified that vision of good teaching. So there was a coherence about what are we aiming for that you could talk about across courses and across settings. Very well-defined standards of practice, a rigorous core curriculum with a very strong grounding around learning and development at the core, curriculum development around the needs of learners and development assessment, and strong emphasis on content pedagogy, Much use of problem-based teaching methods such as cases and action research and portfolios, these will be familiar to all of you. A key, I think, was extended clinical experience. More than 30 weeks in the all of the places organized in a variety of ways with expert veterans who were very carefully selected to instantiate the practices. Linked them very closely to the coursework on teaching and learning. The courses would have assignments that were required work in the classroom. Quite often, in virtually all cases, the coursework and the clinical work were going on at the same time. Not courses that you take and try to remember what you've learned until you get to student teaching several weeks, months, or years later. We also had a study done in New York City where they looked at the gains of student achievement gains of teachers from different programs. And in the upper right-hand quadrant, you see those that had very strong gains for students as a result of their teachers. And very similar features came out in terms of what kind of teacher and program features were relevant. Very carefully developed student teaching that was integrated with the coursework. The courses focused on learning specific tools that were theoretically grounded, but the theory didn't stay at the level of abstraction. It was translated into tools that teachers could apply in clinical experience, reflect on, bring back their reflections, and hone their practice in light of other theory. Coursework in content pedagogy as well as content study of curriculum. How do you construct curriculum? How do you enable students to get from here to there over a long period of time? Not lessons, but curriculum units and long stretches of study so that you could really move students from one set of understandings to another, and then performance assessments. As I've looked around the world, I've seen other things that have really reinforced some of these things and really taken them further. In Finland, at the University of Helsinki, of course, the model schools, which are true of all of the teacher education programs in Finland, attached to the university, owned by the university more or less, the teachers are developed and selected by the university to be models of practice with a very strong research base. And I'm seeing this now in many places around the world. I love the fact that to be admitted as a primary teacher in Finland, the first thing you do is respond to a set of research articles about teaching to see if teachers have that orientation to be inquiring and reflective, as well as learning to use research and then doing research. And that's showing up in lots of places as a key aspect of that theory and practice connection is that teachers do it themselves because they are themselves engaged in the use of and the conduct of research or practice. University of Melbourne's MTeach program, similarly grounded in a research orientation with a lot of work on understanding students' learning progressions and observing where they are in their learning, and then designing interventions, and then evaluating the effect of those interventions, and then deciding on the next courses of study. And then in contexts like the one that Lakehead University of Ontario deals with, where students are immersed in the practice of the culture, curriculum, literacies of the native community that they are preparing to teach in, with deep community engagement, again, where the practice informs the theory and the two are brought together. So I want to just close with a couple of observations about this clinical curriculum, because I think it's the place where, if we can get this right, we will make that connection in a way that enables practitioners to do the work we hope they will be able to do. Obviously, clinical practice is not just being in a classroom. It is not just trial and error learning. It requires explicit modeling of good practice, opportunities to learn under expert supervision, gradually assuming responsibility over a long enough period of time that responsibility can be shifting from worrying about myself as a teacher. Am I doing the right thing? Am I doing okay? Did the kids like me? To worrying about the students and their learning. And then having these very specific clinical experiences that are linked to aspects of teaching practice and powerful theory. We know that there is nothing more practical than good theory. If you see it in action and then you're able to think about, well, how does that, what I know about this aspect of development or learning, generalize to these other situations? So I think that to get there, we need to learn from each other. Many of us are already doing this. All of us are struggling to figure out the best ways to do this, to create these professional teaching schools, these model schools, partner schools, whatever you call it, as in medicine and other professions where you can see good practice, where you can have confidence that state-of-the-art practices are involved. And that we can do that in a way that actually solves some of our key teaching needs. And this is the place where I think societies need teacher education to become most knowledgeable and well-grounded. That this inequity in the allocation of learning opportunities to children, which occurs in many societies, most, also creates a dilemma for teacher education. Because if the most highly developed, sophisticated, successful practices are often seen in the schools serving the more advantaged students, then you want to send student teachers to those schools to see those practices. But if student teachers are, and if the turnover of teachers and the need for teachers is quite often in various schools, those could be in rural areas, they could be in Aboriginal or Native communities, they could be in urban contexts. If those schools are places where teachers need experience, but the experience is not one of sophisticated, highly effective practices, then we're replicating the problem, the inequity that we, in fact, want to solve. So how do we break that problem? We see this situation in the U.S., but I've seen it in other places around the world where the least experienced teachers are often in the highest need schools. There are often higher turnover rates. There's then a high cost to that school or district for having to recruit and train teachers, a high cost to the students who continually have new teachers. And that's partly because the knowledge base and the skill set is much greater for teachers in these contexts and communities. The need to be able to work with students with a wide range of needs, the ability to reach out and work with families in different ways. Many university programs struggle with these challenges, and in order to really provide both the initial preparation and the induction support, there are barriers to overcome. So one part of this may be in the practice of working in partnership closely with schools that work with students with a wide range of needs and cultural backgrounds, and develop the practice in those schools along with the practice in the university. At Stanford, we actually started several schools in high-need communities and then partnered with others to help the veteran teachers learn practices that would be successful while we were also placing student teachers in large numbers there. We have a new strategy in the U.S. called residency programs, where districts and universities together create programs, select the residents into those programs, pay for their preparation, and ensure another 2 years of mentoring and induction. The schools that they are placed in are schools that are teaching academies that are also developing best practices for those students. By the time they have this shared experience with the district and the university, the district then promises them a job at the other end. And what we're seeing as a result of that kind of partnership is that we're both seeing great diversity in the teaching force. In San Francisco, we have such a program. Two-thirds of the residents are teachers of color. And they are staying and teaching at much higher rates. 97% of the residents have stayed in teaching, 80% in that district, compared to the district as a whole having a high turnover rate of half of their teachers leaving in that time and 38% of their new hires leaving. There is a program for Teach for America in San Francisco, as we're seeing in Teach for All programs around the world. Only 20% of them stay 5 years. And the problem, of course, is that students are losing achievement because of the turnover. We know this from a lot of studies. The district is paying the costs of continually recruiting and trying to induct new teachers. There's very little stability, and the shortage problems never get resolved. So, to sum up, what we might focus on as we try to solve these dilemmas is to spend a lot of our energy in figuring out how to develop clinical practice in concert with our theoretical insights. That's going to mean increasingly universities working with districts and schools to transform those settings and to link them closely in the preparation process. When we redesigned the program at Stanford, we went to the schools that we've been working with and said, you know, we don't really want your classrooms. People would come and say, can we get a classroom for a student teacher? We said, we want your expertise. We want schools to work with, teachers to work with, who are devoted to the future of the profession, who want to build that future with us. And schools began to raise their hands and say, yes, we want to work on that agenda with you, rather than you just sending us student teachers. Now, it helps that the student teachers come for a full year, and they actually can make a contribution in that period of time. But I think those school partnerships are at the core of that. And then we need, of course, a way to think about the whole child and the whole school, not just the classroom, to support teachers in developing these two-way pedagogies in which they can understand the context, the culture, the experience of students, and be responsive to that. And then to teach for this kind of inquiry and deeper understanding that our 21st century really requires. At the end of the day, I think our goal in high-achieving 21st century nations has to be to move beyond the old adage that those who can do and those who can't teach, to one that says those who can do and those who understand teach. And those who can teach and those who can't go into a less significant line of work. Thank you.
Thank you, Linda, so much for this rich and comprehensive, theoretically deep and also very practical presentation.
We could learn so... Oh my goodness, that's not... There you go.
It's working. Yes, sometimes it's working. Or it was so huge vision. What is the role of teacher education in the local conditions, condition, but also globally for everyone from us coming from different countries. So we have now 10 minutes for questions and discussion, and I open the floor for your questions and comments. I'm sure that you would like to take opportunity to discuss with Linda. Please, floor is yours. There's time to reflect in silence. Yes, please.
Thank you very much for your very very inspiring presentation. My name is Marco Snoek. I work at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. And I think you gave a very great presentation about your insights and suggestion for additional teacher education. However, you started with the debate about what is the added value of teacher education, and it is constantly contested. And I think one of the reasons for that contestment is the way in which the teaching profession is organized, where from day one after graduation you've got full responsibility as a teacher on your own. This gives the impression that within initial teacher education we have to prepare teachers for all those risk things that we expect teachers to do. And as long as we as universities recognize and accept that perspective, that we must be able as teacher educators to do everything within the limited context of an initial teacher education program, we create the problems ourselves instead of presenting the picture that to become such a rich professional as a teacher doesn't take initial teacher education but takes a much longer time, so we can only do a limited part of that. How's your perception on that? So how does your perception of initial teacher education extend into the longer professional development?
Mm-hmm. It's a great point. When was that causing it? Let's see. And I think that there is a broader social responsibility for thinking about the teacher education process over a period of time. I think in teacher education we can do more than we have sometimes done to get teachers ready for practice at the beginning of their obligations. I don't know if that's the microphone making that noise or not. It's not. It's somebody else. Okay. And I do believe, I think that, you know, for that to happen, one of the things that we have to be sure happens in the initial part of the process is a full year of clinical practice from the first day the kids walk through the door to the last day that they leave, so the teachers see that whole cycle and work through that, and that brings a much different orientation to the beginning of practice. But they're still not ready for all of the things they're going to encounter. And then you need mentoring or induction that is organized to enable them over the next couple of years to grow even deeper. And one of the things that I found very interesting, I've just finished an international study of teaching policies around the world, is that in places like Shanghai and Singapore, where there is not as long a pre-service clinical experience as there would be in Finland, for example, there is a very highly structured coaching and mentoring structure and support system for teachers when they come in. They have a reduced teaching load. There are senior and master and mentor teachers in the schools. There's a career ladder, so these more accomplished teachers are available. There's a lot of time for teachers to work together in collaborative planning, observation, coaching. Something on the order of 15 to 20 hours a week is devoted to other non-teaching activities. So there's the school context. There's the support system. It's organized, funded, expected. It's not left to chance. And that induction is really the continuation of teacher education. And there are seminars that accompany that and so on. That happens in some other countries as well, many of whom don't have all of the other features I just described as supports to it. That is time for the mentor teacher to work closely, the additional reduced teaching load and so on. So I think we do need to think about the initial, perhaps, pre-service and 2 years or so of the career in a very much more structured way than some societies currently do, so that, in fact, it is a continuous process of learning. And that guided clinical experience is present along that continuum. So thank you for raising that.
And any other questions? So what I really agree with that need this mentoring and induction phase after research time. And what we have learned also from different juries around the world, that it's not well and systematically organized in many countries. You mentioned those two countries, Linda, but I think that in most countries it's only occasionally, it's not systematic, it's something depends on the local school, it's not structured. That's something what I think that we have to work very much, how we can create that continuum from pre-service to induction and then systematic in-service training. That has been also European Union recommendation, but how that has been implemented in different countries, it varies and not well implemented at that moment. Yes, please.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation.
Just wait with more microphone.
Thank you. I'm Judith Harford from University College Dublin, Ireland. I really enjoyed your presentation. I was just wondering if you have any insights into how we might make policymakers understand the value and importance of teachers in our society.
You know, societies are so different in this regard. You know, there are some places, of course, where teachers are recognized and accepted as critical to the society, and that really depends on your own particular brand of policymakers. Coming from the U.S., where we now have Donald Trump on the way to becoming president, I don't think I can give advice on how to persuade policymakers to be sensible. It's not our forte. But I will say that in some societies where I've seen the status of teaching and the recognition of the importance of investments in teaching improve over time, there has been a concerted effort by the profession itself to kind of organize and articulate in a collective fashion both a path to achieving that expertise and an insistence on its importance in ways that also bring individual legislators and others along. You know, there are the profession sometimes has in some societies been sort of victimized and then has come to behave like a victim. And there's been this view that, well, we can't change it, it's just the way it is, we just have to hunker down and try to, you know, as opposed to becoming more political and becoming more engaged in the policy and political process. And I think that where the profession has been able to be unified in that way, that I've seen more progress being made.
Yes. There is one question, please.
My name is Timothy Murphy from the University of Limerick, and I wonder if you could speak a little bit, Professor Hammond, to the challenge around increasing sort of accountability, top-down pressures on the profession vis-a-vis bottom-up professional development processes that sometimes get squeezed in what's referred to as the surveillance culture, and how it might be possible to protect spaces for the autonomy and increasing confidence and professional accountability of teachers.
I wish you'd say a little bit more about that. Can you say a little bit more about the surveillance culture?
I suppose what comes to mind is the increasing sort of auditing type accountability, the performance culture. That can sometimes become all encompassing and consuming, and can sometimes detract from the other important realities and responsibilities of the profession.
Mm-hmm. Did you want to say something about it?
Yeah.
ultimately, I think when you have a well-developed, a mature profession, the accountability is within the professional community itself, rather than coming top-down or from the outside through an inspection model of some sort. And the places where strong professional learning communities are growing, where teachers are organized and organizing themselves into action research groups, into groups that are engaged in their own coaching, observation, mentoring, lesson study kinds of activities, I think provide a more effective, deeper, better rooted accountability or responsibility structure than an outside surveillance, like I'm going to come into your classroom and do a walkthrough or whatever it may be that might be the inspection modality. And I've seen those taking root, these learning communities and professional inquiry communities, with a lot of government support in some places. And again, I think about Singapore as one of the places where the kind of the action research, Shanghai is another, where there's a real acceptance of the idea that the expertise resides within the professional community, and the goal of management is to allow that expertise to be shared, between and among the educators themselves. And I think that's a frame for management that we need to also be developing. As we're thinking about teacher education, we have to be thinking about leader education. And what is the management framework, the professional framework that school leaders bring, hopefully as they've come from the teaching profession with that set of values and understandings?
So thank you so much, Linda, for these excellent reflections. I was saying that we have to now end up our discussion, but still there are one urgent question, please, Sandra.
It's not an urgent question, but I feel I can't just let the occasion go past without asking you regarding the issue of raising teacher education to master level. Locally in Malta, we've been dealing with this, we've been, but to a certain extent also struggling with this for the past, year, I would say. Of course, I understand that a decision to move teacher education to master level is also conditioned by the contextualization in which teacher education actually takes place. From, however, your experience also in the States, having a master degree like the MTeach that you mentioned, or in the case that we are introducing here in Malta, an MTL, Master in Teaching and Learning, as is the case of several contexts within the European Union, is this actually more conducive to better quality teaching? I know that this is a question that you cannot answer in 2 minutes, but I'd really appreciate reflections that you might wish to share with us.
I think it's really important to focus as much on the content of and strategies for teacher education as the level. So many societies have, we have places like Finland that have gone all the way to the master's level for teacher education for all teachers, but there are also lots of places where undergraduate and master's level teacher education programs live side by side. A weak master's degree program is not better than a strong undergraduate program. And I've seen that, that quite often if you have very little time at the master's level, there are places that have a one-year model, some have a two, some have longer. But the key is having thoughtful, powerful coursework linked to clinical work that is of sufficient duration that is in the right places that the teacher can learn. So I think you can do that at the undergraduate level or at the master's degree level. In some universities, the way that teacher education came into the university has made it hard to do good clinical work because the way the coursework is organized has various, you know, departmental constraints. And sometimes then it's easier to get out of that and go to the master's level and have a school of education that can integrate the work. Other places, the undergraduate programs are doing fine work. They've figured out how to integrate clinical and coursework in productive ways. And I wouldn't throw that away lightly just to go to a master's degree program. So I think it depends on the context. I'm in California. We went to master's level, graduate level teacher education in 1970. And now we're replanting undergraduate programs. And the reason is that we have shortages of teachers, and we have no financial aid for people at the master's degree level. And we can either take people who are untrained for teaching, or we can start building the programs in the undergraduate space that we got rid of 45 years ago. So I think it's a complicated question that has to do with how you can be sure that candidates are well supported and where you can provide the best quality programming for them in your context.
Yeah, so thank you so much for this answer. And I can also confirm this important message that if there is master level teacher education as we have in Finland, it depends very much how courses are implemented, structured, what is the quality of that master program. So it's not as itself any use.
And I think in addition, just one last point. In Finland, if you, when you decide to be a teacher, the government pays all of the cost for you to become a teacher. And then you can think about whether people can survive and sustain themselves in a master's level program. But if you're in a context where that's not the case, you will create shortages for yourself if you make that jump without the financial support.
So now I think that we have to end up this session, and we really thank Linda for a great session. I just want to make a couple of housekeeping announcements before we break for coffee. As you know, we will have the parallel sessions after the coffee break. They will start at 10:30. Each presentation will take around 30 minutes, so people are free to move around from one session to the other every 30 minutes, every 30 minutes interval. In the parallel session 1A, we have one of the presentations, the last one, which has been cancelled, a last-minute cancellation. So those of you who are going to the parallel session 1A, there will be three presentations, not four. We also have two tickets for tonight's dinner that are for sale. There were some guests who are coming for dinner, and they cannot come anymore. So if any of you are interested in coming for dinner, we have two tickets that you can buy. I think... Yes, the parallel sessions are downstairs. There are rooms adjacent to each other with the signage of where the presentations will be allocated. So have a nice coffee break, and we'll meet for the parallel sessions. Thank you.
Do you have a session coming up? I think I have marked one on my clock.
What's it?
Yeah, I
will have
to.
Jason here.
Many things. So, still going.